Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. This is Tracy Morgan, your host. And I will be joined today with co-host Josie Oppenheim, returning once again to help out with this interview. We invited Oppenheim to come because she's on the research faculty at the Center for Modern Psychoanalytic Studies. And the book that we'll be talking about today pertains to psychoanalytic research. And we're speaking with Robert Hinshelwood about his book, Research on the Couch, Single Case Studies, Subjectivity, and Psychoanalytic Knowledge. Robert Hinshelwood is, I believe, our second British author. We did interview Susie Orbach, so we're quite pleased to be making our way across the pond. But Robert Hinshelwood is a professor in the Center for Psychoanalytic Studies at the University of Essex. Previously, he served as a consultant psychotherapist in the British National Health Service for 20 years, and then was clinical director at the Castle Hospital in London. He's a fellow of the British Psychoanalytical Society and a fellow of the Royal College of Psychiatrists. He's authored a Dictionary of Kleinian Thought, which was published in 1989, and other books and articles largely on Kleinian psychoanalysis. In 2000, he published Observing Organizations, which was edited with Wilhelm Gottstad, I hope I pronounced that correctly, and in that book, they apply psychoanalytic observation to social science. 2004 saw the publication of his book, Suffering and Sanity, on schizophrenia in psychiatric institutions. Hinshelwood is also a founder of the British Journal of Psychotherapy and the Journal of Psychoanalysis in History. So we're very pleased to have him with us. Before we get started, I also wanted to alert the listeners to a change that will be taking place. You'll probably notice it this summer. It's something to look forward to. In New Books and Psychoanalysis, we are expanding our hosts. We're adding a really terrific group of hosts so that we hope to begin to cover more and more and more psychoanalytic books. My goal is that we cover everything published in English every year that we can and move from there. So that's a very exciting prospect, and you can look forward to hearing from new thinkers and new authors and new hosts. So without further ado, let's move to the interview. Hi, and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. My name is Tracy Morgan. I'm here once again with Josie Oppenheim, who will be working together on this interview. And today we have with us Robert Hinshelwood, and we'll be discussing with him his new publication, Routledge 2013, entitled Research on the Couch, Single Case Studies, Subjectivity, and Psychoanalytic Knowledge. So welcome.
Hello.
Hello. Hello from England.
Nice to meet you, and thank you for taking the time.
Well, you came highly recommended from our friend Orna Ophir, and that you would be very good to speak to. So Josie Oppenheim is, as I think I mentioned to you, also on the research committee of the Center for Modern Psychoanalytic Studies. So it was a great pleasure to be able to ask her to come and take part in this. The first question that every author is asked, more or less, in New Books in Psychoanalysis is, what motivated you, what drove you, however you want to put it, to write this book? Could you tell us?
Yes, there's a number of different routes to the motivation. Partly is the concern that there is about psychoanalytic knowledge and whether it's valid knowledge. Insurance companies in the United States, state health services in Britain and on the continent are all asking for evidence for therapeutic interventions. And there's always the view that psychoanalysis doesn't have adequate evidence. This is not entirely true. There's an awful lot of evidence which gets discounted. And I was interested that psychoanalysts seem to have been pushed into a crisis of confidence about the validity of their knowledge. And there are a lot of projects now going on in Britain, the continent, Europe, and in America that's trying to produce evidence on the basis of outcome. Great, I think that's fine. My second thought was that Freud always thought that research produced knowledge from the clinical setting, and all of his major case histories and all of the major developments are supported with by his discussion of the clinical context, clinical process. So these were some of my interests. In addition, I'm not a Freud basher at all. I have a great respect for him, but I do get anxious that psychoanalysis itself shoots itself in the foot by having so many different competing theories. And what this amounts to is that we can't really seem to decide amongst ourselves which are our best theories, so that we have a whole range of different ideas and concepts which have been called a Tower of Babel. And David Tuckett says, well, anything goes. Anybody's got a bright idea is in a position to just promote it. Isn't there something we can do, I thought? Shouldn't we be thinking about what we can do to decide which of our ideas are the best ones, which are better than others, or which are better for what purpose than others? Shouldn't we have some system for weeding and pruning? And then this brings us to the question, is psychoanalysis like material science, which does have a system of testing the best ideas? So these things are mulling around in my head at a time in the late 90s when I left my work. I retired from my work in the public service and the National Health Service in Britain and went to teach in a university at the Center for Psychoanalytic Studies, as it was called, in my university. That's the University of Essex. And there were lots of eager students, also lots of eager academics around the university who were challenging, interested, sympathetic to psychoanalytic ideas, but who wanted to think about, what is the nature of psychoanalytic knowledge? And I ran a course for more than 10 years on a critical methodology. How does one get knowledge out of the clinical situation, which is where most of our knowledge comes from? Nearly all our knowledge comes from the clinical situation. So I spent 10 years trying to teach this, and as is always the case, you learn more when you teach something than when you go on a course as a participant. Anyway, so I learned, I don't know what my students learned, but I learned a lot about what were the questions that should be asked and thinking about ways in which they might be answered. What is psychoanalytic knowledge and how can we know that it is valid? So those were the sort of, that's the background to the book, Research on the Couch. It is about research from the clinical situation and the clinical process. So in short, that's the beginning of the book.
Right. Did you have a question of questions here that we want to ask that sort of revolve around some of this, right?
Hi. One of the problems, as you point out, is that the instrument used for gathering information in scientific research is the mind, which is the object of investigation in psychoanalysis.
Yes.
In other words, if I understand you correctly, we are a little bit as if in the quantum world. In order to look at our mind, we must change our position and so have altered the object we are attempting to perceive. How do you suggest we manage this difficulty with respect to psychoanalytic research?
Yes, this is a major, major problem. I think that's true. And a lot of my book tries to address that difficulty. I have to say, I don't know if I've cracked the problem, but what I'm saying with the book is that we ought to keep thinking about this sort of problem, and if my book doesn't really adequately deal with the problem, then somebody else needs to write another book which will deal better with the problem.
That's the research model, all right?
That's a sort of research model, isn't it?
Yes.
But it's true that I think psychoanalysis is not really one of the natural sciences because it doesn't deal with facts about the material, physical world. Mm-hmm. It deals with our experiences. And that makes it, it seems to me, a very different animal from natural science. And this is where I part company from Freud, actually, who thought that that psychoanalysis is a natural science like any other, I think he said, something like that in the Outline of Psychoanalysis late in his life. I think it isn't, and I think we ought to honour the particular difference that we are dealing with subjective facts as opposed to material facts in natural science. Bob Caper wrote a book called Immaterial Facts, which is a nice slogan and makes the difference. I think we should recognize that and perhaps be a bit proud of the fact that we're doing something a little bit different. But it brings in train a number of difficult problems, one of which is the one you mentioned, that in order to develop a body of subjective data, we need a subjective instrument. How else could we find subjective data if it isn't with a subjective instrument like our minds? But this then creates the difficulty that we are vulnerable to criticisms about the subjectivity of our observations, how we see what we want to see. And a good deal of the book is trying to understand how we might be able to be more confident that our observations and the theories of we arrive at from our observations are not just wishful thinking based on our own subjectivity. The particular, shall I go on about this, or do you want to?
Well, I wanted to comment on that. I think that I like the idea that you have about boosting the confidence of the analyst by being able to produce some research, because I am concerned about our loss of cachet and. Mm-hmm. And confidence, I'm in favor of what can we do to boost that. I guess a question I have. You raised something before about you used the term experience that we have immaterial facts, and I want to quote you in the book. You say much of the predicament of psychoanalysis today is that the core problems of focusing on experience severely restricts the strength of the claim to be scientific. And when I read this, it brought to mind the work of a historian, and my background is in history as well as psychoanalysis, a woman named Joan Wallach Scott, who wrote a brilliant essay probably 20 years ago here in the States called The Evidence of Experience. Mm. And so she's writing as a historian, but she tells us that, I'm going to quote her, experience is at once always already an interpretation and something that needs to be interpreted. What counts as experience is neither self-evident nor straightforward. It is always contested and always, therefore, she writes, political. The study of experience, therefore, must call into question its originary status. So that's her quote. And I was thinking both analysts and historians, interestingly, traffic in history and the attempt to grasp the subjectivity of the subjects we study, be they documents from the past or the patient before us. And yet claiming to know from, quote, experience can stymie both modes of inquiry. So the question is, I think people in the listening audience will be interested in this as well, is how do we as analysts define experience? Or in other words, how do we know we have legitimate psychoanalytic data?
Yes, that's the big question.
That's why we're asking.
As a whole, yes. Yes, that's right. I probably duck the question of what is experience, and I probably should read up the essay that you were describing by the historian. Yes,
yeah.
I think my position starts again with Freud, where he says somewhere, I think in one of the introductory lectures, it's all in the book, that when we say something about a patient's experience, when we make an interpretation, it has to tally with something or other in the patient. And I think that's the crucial issue. Whatever experience is, it is something which you can touch in the patient with an interpretation. And then the question is, how do we assess whether we've touched that bit of the patient or that bit of the patient's experience? And quite a lot of the book is devoted to understanding how in a clinical situation we can assess whether we have said something which tallies with something in the patient. Yes, I suppose I was also thinking in relation to what you were saying about that historical essay. We're not just concerned with conscious experience either. There's something that is mysteriously thought of as the unconscious experience, mm-hmm. that which is behind dreams. So we're in a very murky area, groping our way in a fog. But it's Freud's remark about tallying with something in the patient. I don't know, you probably know Adolf Grunbaum took this up as the tally principle. I thought this was good. I thought Grunbaum, one of the great Freud bashers, actually said some sensible and helpful things as well. Nothing is all bad.
He didn't know what he meant. He didn't know exactly what he was saying.
Yeah.
Right. His unconscious maybe. Spoke. We caught it. Right.
So I think one of the issues we have to think about in terms of the research in the clinical setting is how do we assess whether we have said something which tallies and touches the patient in a way which can then be claimed as a piece of data. When I said this, the patient said something or other. What sort of things would the patient say which made us think that we had touched something in the patient? Okay, just an aside, because it's my skepticism about psychoanalysis and and the way that a lot of psychoanalysis is practiced is that psychoanalysts in their busy days, full of tension and anxiety, tend to operate in such a way that they like to fit the patient to their theories. This is something I think that Marshall Edelson talks about. And this is not research. It may be useful clinically, but it's not research to fit a patient to the theory. It's often not quite what the patient wants either, to be boxed into a piece of theory.
Right,
so it requires us, I think, to be attentive to what happens with our patients when we make interpretations, and how can we know that when we've made an interpretation which has touched him, tallied with something in him, and when we've made an interpretation which, however much it sounds right and makes sense to us, doesn't touch the patient because he is actually occupied with a different kind of sense or different set of meanings to his own experience. It's been a long tradition, actually, in psychoanalysis that what you do is you look at the response to an interpretation and to see how the patient is affected by the interpretation, and not just consciously, but produces from their unconscious associations which might be confirming, might produce a dream in the next session, etc. So a lot of the argument in the book is about how we can deal with this question by examining the response to interpretations.
I think that you're going to, that I felt in the book that you were going a step further in the sense that I think in a way we're all conducting, I agree that we're all conducting research with our patients, that psychoanalysis is a form of research in and of itself. But I had the idea in reading your book that you felt that there was a way that we could, for example, compare
metapsychologies,
which is a much more complex thing than guessing or verifying that we've somehow touched the experience. And probably more problematic, more ambitious, and extremely interesting. So I wondered if you could say something about that.
I think it's a very pertinent point. First of all, I think probably most interpretations carry within them some metapsychology, that the interpretation has some conviction for the analyst because it draws on some metapsychological idea or theory that the analyst is personally committed to. The question then is about I think the question then is how do we assess if that interpretation is a valid one that touches the patient, and if it does, I think we're entitled to say that the metapsychological theory that is embedded in or inspires the interpretation is probably a valid piece of metapsychology, perhaps for this particular patient or with these particular problems or dynamics or whatever. So I think the validity of a piece of metapsychology is tested by the way in which the interpretation evokes as some sort of valid response. I think, though, that the really complicated bit is to assess what is a valid response in the patient. And one of the problems, you see, is that people who have a loyalty to one particular metapsychological theory will assess a response to an interpretation in terms of that metapsychological theory. And people who hold another metapsychological theory will assess the response to an interpretation in terms of their alternative theory. So that just taking the response to an interpretation is not enough. The problem is that you need to understand the conditions of the response, what its features are, how it comes about, in order to know if it is if it validates the theory. One of the things I try to do in the book, successfully or not, I don't know, you can tell me, okay. But it's to say that the response to the interpretation needs to be assessed in terms of theories which are separate from the metapsychological theory which goes into the interpretation. I don't know if that's an easy thing to absorb, but I tried to divide psychoanalytic theory into two kinds: metapsychological theory, which contributes to making sense of the associations and constructing an interpretation, and what's called by some people, George Klein, I believe, Robert Wallerstein, it's called clinical theory, which is looking at which is theory used to look at the clinical process that goes on, and so that the validity of a theory inspiring an interpretation is looked at in terms of the clinical theory, which makes sense of the process from the associations before the interpretation to the associations after the interpretation. Is that all too complicated? I feel it's extremely complicated.
That's beautifully complicated.
Beautifully complicated. That's a nice way to put it.
I guess my question for the, as thinking of the listeners and myself, is what are we meaning by clinical theory? How is that different? I mean, we, for example, the modern school has a very strong attitude about clinical theory, but I don't know exactly what you would be meaning when you say clinical theory as opposed to metapsychological theory.
It's difficult to make a distinction, but I dodged the issue a little bit by drawing on Robert Wallerstein and his paper, when was it, 1990, was it?
Yeah, I think so.
Which he talked about the common ground when he was president of the IPA. Mm-hmm. And he selected a small list of theories which used to understand clinical process, particularly transference and countertransference and anxiety and defense. And if one restricts one's assessment of the response to interpretation to those theories, then my claim is that we're able to ask about the validity of all that other range of metapsychological theories, which are a Tower of Babel to be validated. So if one looks at the transference and countertransference as it evolves in terms of the patient's anxiety and the defenses they use against the anxiety, how does the interpretation change the anxiety defense balance in the patient so that the transference and countertransference changes after the interpretation? Those are the conditions, I think, which are necessary for understanding whether the response to an interpretation validates the metapsychology.
That makes that. Sense.
Yeah, I get it. That makes sense.
Okay. I mean, that sounds very useful.
Well, it might be useful. It needs to be worked out in practice. I have tried to give some examples towards the end of the book how this might play out with actual clinical material and actual cases. There are... I mean, I draw particularly on the idea of countertransference, and as it has been developed, at least in British psychoanalysis, perhaps South American psychoanalysis, since 1950, and I think rather later in American psychoanalysis. But I am particularly interested in the way countertransference helps us to understand how the patient is struggling with the transference anxieties and the defenses that are set up in the transference to handle those anxieties. So that countertransference is quite an important element as understood in an object relations paradigm.
Sure.
Now, of course, you may say, oh, well, yes, but isn't this prioritizing object relations metapsychology as opposed to ego psychology, self psychology, relational psychoanalysis, and so on? And maybe it is. Or maybe it is valid to look at transference and countertransference as a psychoanalytic process there in front of you in the session and is in some way separate from those theories which don't deal with process in the session but deal with meanings which can be interpreted.
Right. Like the Lacanians would probably not using a lot of countertransference, I don't think, as information. This model might not work. Might not work as well. Just a thought as I'm listening to you and learning some more. I wanted to ask you a question more about sort of the position that the profession is in and the relationship of research to that position, which is, you know, that we're a bit downtrodden. And I have a quote from, I don't know if you know his work at all, Barnaby Barrett, who's, I believe he's a South African analyst. And he takes quite a strong stance. And he says, as is well known, there's a tradition of opposition to the method of the psychoanalytic discourse by, quote, analytic philosophers, whom you discuss and deal with in the book. Those identified with conventional thinking about what is and is not scientific. And then he says, the history of our various responses to such criticism has, by and large, not been a tale of valor and clear-sightedness. We fail to appreciate that the method of psychoanalysis might inherently conflict with the metaphysical or ideological canons of official science itself. The reaction of our leading thinkers to the protagonists of official science has always been defensive. And then he says, I believe quite unnecessarily so. Offense would be more appropriate. The sense I had when reading your book is it looks like it's an attempt using sort of a research method, but it's an attempt to nevertheless take the offensive.
Yes.
So could you sort of talk about research on the offensive?
Research
on the offensive, however you want to phrase it.
Well, yes, that deserves a paper, doesn't it? Research on the offensive. I mean, I agree that psychoanalysts have not been particularly good at challenging the criticisms that have been increasingly levelled really since the end of the Second World War by philosophers as well as other psychologists. I'm not a philosopher. I originated as a doctor and a psychiatrist before I became a psychoanalyst. So I'm a completely amateur philosopher struggling with some of the philosophical ideas which I try to make sense of in the book we're discussing. But I think that's true of a great many psychoanalysts, that we have a sense that we have a theory of mind, but that we really don't know properly how that theory of mind is placed within the various theories of mind that operate within philosophy and that have been argued for whatever 2,500 years of Western philosophy. So I think I agree with Barnaby Barrett that we haven't done too well at challenging these things. I think with some sympathy that most analysts are occupied with a tough job in the consulting room, listening to a lot of anxiety, which does all sorts of things to the analyst's own personality. And we perhaps don't have the time or the mental space to take on board some of these issues, which really need to be addressed. When I went from my health service practice to the university, I thought it's probably my responsibility as an analyst to be able at the university to devote time and space in my mind to trying to think about these things. And this book is a result of some of those attempts to understand theories of mind. My sense is that that psychoanalysis is probably not exactly the same as a natural science. It's probably a bit more than the hermeneuticists say, that it is just about making meanings, and they sometimes almost seem to be saying, well, any old meaning is good for the patient, a bit like vitamins. You give people vitamins and it makes them healthy. You give people meanings and that makes their minds work better. I think there's something a bit more specific that we have to attend to and take an interest in, and I think it isn't quite like natural science, as I said before, it's because we are occupied with a non-material world, immaterial facts. I think that puts it beside natural science, and I hope it doesn't put it against natural science, but puts it beside natural science, and that my book is an attempt to produce a model of testing which is a bit like, it has the logic of the scientific testing, but takes account of the very different kinds of facts and evidence which we inevitably have to work with. I think that's something we should put forward. If I'm a more of a political sort of person, I think I would like to go on the offensive more and go to philosophical conferences and play.
It's more of a stay away from my defenses. I'm going to go on the offense. I think something I liked a lot about the book was the attempt to say it's not natural science, but it's not natural science. And I think what we struggle with in psychoanalysis, and particularly as it relates to sort of the, for lack of a better term, the general public, is if it's not mental health profession necessarily, it's not science, well, then natural science, then what is it? And we were joking around before the interview, Josie and I, we said something like, it's funny, all this, the push, not so much that your book is pushing this, but there's the sense of being on the defensive. So let's prove that our work is good and let's show our research. And Josie and I were laughing and saying, yeah, but everybody's getting acupuncture, chiropractic, doing Tai Chi and taking vitamins. And there's there are plenty of studies that prove these things aren't, necessarily good, might be okay, might be deleterious. It doesn't stop people. It's something at the level, we're thinking it's more at the level of sort of popular discourse that we need to try to figure out how to intervene on behalf of psychoanalysis. I mean, it doesn't matter. People go to the chiropractor whether it's good for them or not. Research isn't going to change it very much, I don't think, in the end. It's popular in the culture.
Yes, I understand what you're saying, that what's the point of intervention to take the offensive? And it may be in terms of popular culture. I'm sure that's not bad. You can tell there's a but. I think it's the same in America, but I'm not sure. But in Britain and the continent, the particular concern is about funding agencies that are not particularly aware of public opinion, except in the sense that they are spending public money, and they want to be assured that they're spending public money on things that are good for the public. So I think one has to think in terms of these rather official bodies, medical insurance, state-funded health, healthcare, and so on, as well as public opinion. That's the particular context of the situation that I think we're in Europe. It may be different in America, and I don't know. But in those with those bodies, the what leads the what's the brand leader is science. Anything that looks a bit like science is given a much more serious reading, therefore can influence the flow of public money or maybe medical insurance money to both research but also clinical treatment. That's the, I suppose that I'm saying is an important important area where we need to have influence, as well as in public opinion. I think public opinion will take care of itself, probably. There will always be people who want to be listened to. And that will mean there will always be people interested in coming to analysts, as well as, you say, coming to other forms of therapy where the therapist makes a point of listening and taking an interest in the person as a person. So I have a sort of faith in human nature that they will... that there is always the interest in being listened to. That's not the same with public funding and medical insurance funding. They want to know that there's something that's got credentials to it, or science-like credentials to it. And that's really a significant area which I would hope we can influence, whether it's with my book or with somebody else's book that's a bit along the same lines, doesn't matter. But I think that's where we have to really take the offensive. Well, it may be different in America.
It's different.
I'm not so familiar with culture there. I've not been many times.
I think if anything, it's a little worse here.
Yes.
Certainly feel much more cynical than I hear you. Oh, what's happening? Is this better?
There you go.
Yeah. Okay. You know, my thought is that the insurance company.
Hold on one sec.
Sorry, we're having a little technical difficulty. It must be the companies not wanting to hear me say this.
Yes, I'm sure.
So what I wanted to say is that I, you know, in a certain sense, neuroscience, for example, has really supported psychoanalytic thinking. It seems to me lately, they really seem to be. Why is this happening? It wasn't happening before.
I don't know. Something's happening. Hold on. I would sit back if you can. Stay away from.
Are you able to hear me, Bob?
Yes, okay. I can hear you. There's a bit of an echo going on. But
yeah.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Neuroscience seems to be supporting a lot of our thinking. It seems to be showing that thinking goes on in the unconscious areas of the mind and things of that nature.
Yes.
But I think that that even if we were to prove, which I that we were scientifically valid, I have the feeling that that wouldn't necessarily be enough, because in our country, managed care certainly doesn't want to be paying for long-term therapy.
Yes.
Which is what we are. So there's that. And so I have come to the position to connect up with what you said about liking to be political. I have come to the position that it's almost not a psychoanalytic, not a problem of psychoanalysis alone, that we actually are just in the middle of a situation where a lot of things that might be beneficial to human beings is not necessarily on the forefront of anybody's interest. That, in other words, it's not a corporate concern. Corporate concern is with the bottom line. So,
yes.
I don't know. I don't know if this is a question or a goading or.
It's probably goading, but I agree with you that we get into political discussions here, and what are Well, really, what are the values of our society? And I think this certainly goes way beyond the book that we're discussing, but I think it's not entirely irrelevant. It's a context in which the sort of debate that we need to have has to take place. Right. What are the values of our society? And it's... I suppose I feel perhaps a little bit despairing that sort of abstract value, money value, can so often trump human values of truth and concern and care, particularly in healthcare. But this is a slightly different area of interest, which... I agree with you, is connected.
Right.
And maybe we do have to have some strategy for clutching onto the coattails of hard science like neuroscience, like experimental psychology of the mother-infant relationship and so on, which can be investigated with the more proper natural science methods. Mm-hmm. But I think that doesn't get us away from the need ourselves to put our house in order when we've actually, in my view, got too many different competing theories which aren't really ever allowed to properly compete with each other because we don't have a good method of showing which wins the competition, you know, which theory is better than another theory. Without that, we have a situation where, you know, almost anybody can find three patients with a common dynamic, and then this becomes the latest great theory in psychoanalysis. This isn't good enough. We need to have a proper method comparing our different theories. We need a sort of standard rule, which, rule as a ruler, which will measure something or other. It can't measure it in quantitative terms because subjectivity is not quantitative in the way that material things are. But that we still need to have something which will be a standard against which we can measure our various theories with, in the long run, a need to weed and prune all the undergrowth of entangled theories we got.
Right. Well, I don't know if we have too much time left, do we?
No, you would. Interviewer, please.
Okay. So I thought I would be a devil's advocate and bring it back to psychoanalysis and say that this research, this idea of doing research is very interesting, but I'm wondering, I know you have an interest in Beyond. In fact, I'm reading as we speak one of that book, Beyond Sources, which I think is absolutely fantastic. I want to go on record as saying.
Oh, yes.
Fantastic scholarship and really fascinating for anyone interested in Beyond. But I, how do we do research and still engage with Beyond's dictum of going into each session without memory or desire, for example? How are we going to be doing research and walking into that session without a research mind?
Well, I'm not advocating that people adopt a research mind when they go into a clinical session. I think clinicians should go into a session with a clinical frame of mind, one based on intuition, inspiration, what's beyond called the idea of reverie that one allows things to evolve in one's mind. I think that's an important clinical principle. Mm-hmm. I think what I'm advocating is that there is a research moment in that when you take the plunge and use something which has evolved in your mind to say something to the patient, then what happens? You are engaged not just in the evolution of new meanings, new senses, which are uncontaminated with prior memories and with the desire to treat and cure and so on. One's not just interested in those new thoughts which come, but in a process that is set going in the interaction between two minds, a process which has an outcome. And I think we have to think in terms of Beyond's, I think Beyond's ideas about memory and desire are important. Perhaps I don't think they're as important as some people think, because they remind me particularly of Freud's idea of free-floating attention, right. And I suspect Beyond got a lot of his ideas from that. But
let's do some research.
There is another purchase we have to have on our clinical acumen, and that is to be able to think in terms of a process as well as an evolving meaning in one's mind. There's an evolving process in the interaction between analyst and patient. I'm very much in favor of the notion of an intersubjectivity, although I don't quite go along with an analytic third object. I think the third is a process which is created between analyst and patient. I don't know if that's that makes sense, or if I'm just waffling, but I'm saying there's something about an emerging meaning in experience, something in the mind, and then there is also, rather separately, a process which is set going by this evolved meaning. And it's the second of these, the process, which I think is the research moment. Uh-huh. I'm saying there is a connection, I think. I would say that what Beyond has tried to describe as the way of evolving meanings and sense in the session is important, but there is also the process that we expect that evolution of some meaningful sense to have an effect on the patient.
Bob, I think we're going to have to draw this to a close. I'm sure you have to go have dinner or something, right? It's late over there, much later over there by you than by us. But wanted to thank you very much. We could have gone on for quite a long time, and you have so many books. I chose this one because I had just done a single case study, very different in form and structure from what you were recommending, but I wanted to sort of noctroglicite, like go back and say, oh, okay, what is research on the couch, having just completed it. So I really want to thank you for spending the time with us, and I have a feeling that we'll interview you more, because you have so many books. So if you enjoyed yourself, send us an email and let us know what you want to be interviewed about, and we'll try to do what we can to, over time, because you're very prolific, get to your work. Did you want to say?
No, just that this has been a great pleasure for me. It's been wonderful to talk to you, and I'm glad that I was able to do it.
Can I thank you too for your interest and your fair-minded approach to my work. It's been very enjoyable.
Well, that's the idea, is for it to be enjoyable. So I'm pleased that you found it as such. So this is Tracy Morgan, your host as always with Jesse Oppenheim, the guest interviewer, guest host. We're going to be signing off for now, and tune in until next time, where we'll be speaking with Stephen Kuchuk on his book, Clinical Implications of the Psychoanalyst Life Experience, When the Personal Becomes Professional. So, Bob, until then, we look forward to talking to you more, that's for sure. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.